our Constitution may be hanging by a thread that our state legislators hold a scissor to. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And with me today is Chuck Michaels, my Vice Chairman, Technical Wizard, and Constitutional Teacher. Thanks for being here, Chuck.
And thank you for having me, and thank you for inviting us into your cars, homes, or wherever.
And hopefully that wherever is someplace safe where they're not trying to do this while operating heavy machinery, because hopefully we're not putting anybody to sleep.
That's
out
right.
There. I know this is sometimes a dry subject, because what we're talking about is the operation of our Constitution and how the federal government's power and the state government's power interact, specifically in this area of the call for an Article 5 Constitutional Convention. Senate Joint Resolution 2 is the issue that we've got before us right now. We've talked about it earlier this week. A couple of things we haven't talked about. One of the things that this resolution does is that it makes a paragraph in it says, resolved that if 2/3 of the legislatures of the several states make application to the Congress to call a constitutional convention, which is the standard under Article 5 for the number, so 34 states. So when 34 states make that call, the state of Ohio requests that such a convention be called not later than 6 months after the Congress receives the 34th application from a state legislature. Now, you and I discussed this offline here the other day, and that really sets up a real issue with Article 6 and the Supremacy Clause.
Well, that's right, because this is a legitimate, as opposed to many illegitimate that we mentioned yesterday, this is a legitimate Article 6 issue. And that's the Supremacy Clause. And in fact, the state legislatures have no power to bind the federal legislature.
Right. Now, and again, and I understand that the pushback will be, well, we're just requesting them to do so. However, if Congress would cede to that request and then dial up a convention inside of 6 months from the last call being made and actually have it convene within 6 months, we're going to have a situation where probably not a lot of thought is going to go into, from either end, whether it be from Congress or from the states, delegate selection.
Oh, I have an idea that those who have been agitating for a constitutional convention already have a great big list and a great big set of criteria already set up. Here's what I would just about guarantee a federal list would include judges, law professors, constitutional scholars, quote unquote, and I really have minor respect in many cases. I hate to say that. That's not a good thing, but I have minor respect for a lot of people touted as constitutional scholars, because they automatically adopt, in 99% of the cases, they automatically adopt a living document stance. So let's see, who else? There will be a certain number of seats that will be for organized labor. There will be a certain number of seats for minorities. There will be a certain number of seats that will be required for very specialized, handicapped or, those kind of things. There will be a list of criteria that someone will have worked out. And the fact is that the states really have no power to bind and would be bound, unfortunately, because of the lack of knowledge, because of the lack of language in Article 5, would be bound to what the federals decided they had to do.
Yes, because if Congress passes a resolution of their own or an actual bill that spells out the standards for delegates, including the number of delegates each state may send to a convention, and there's no guarantee that that will be equal to their congressional representation. There won't be any guarantees at all as to whether or not certain states will get multiple individuals who can come to a convention, and other states may only get one. There's also nothing in Article 5 that speaks to how many votes each state will get in convention. Now, we know with the original 1787 convention, each state had one vote. Right. They could send a number of delegates. Some states sent three. Some states sent half a dozen.
It was based on population.
It was based more on population.
But not necessarily. I mean, basically, the state legislatures were allowed to send as a certain number, but the, it doesn't matter because if they sent one guy, if they sent 12, they got one vote in the convention, mm-hmm. except in committee things they got to vote. There were numerous rules, numerous committees. It's too complex to go into, but
ultimately at the end of the day, when the vote came on the final document, each colony was allotted one state, one vote. And so, but you know what? As you just said,
they had to have a quorum of their delegates.
Yes, they did. You couldn't just have. Well, let's say if you had three delegates, if only one was there. That didn't constitute a quorum, so you couldn't vote. And that's what happened in New York.
In New York.
Because Alexander Hamilton was there, but the other two delegates, which the governor had handpicked because...
Well, the legislature picked them.
The legislature picked. Well, the governor had a play in that as well. But the point is the other two delegates had left.
Yep. So until, they went home.
But they finally got them to come back and...
No, actually they didn't.
Oh, that's true.
Yates and Lansing abandoned the convention in July. Alexander Hamilton actually abandoned it in June and came back and did committee work, but was not allowed to vote on the final product.
That's true. I forgot about that. But the thing that raised the thought to me as you said it was that there's nothing in Article 5, because it's dead silent, to keep Congress from making the first requirement for delegates to be that they're sitting congressmen.
Oh, absolutely nothing.
Because if you were looking at proportional representation, that's what Congress is. Each state's allotted so many Congress people by virtue of their population in their state. So we could end up with a situation, because Article 5 doesn't specify that these people cannot also be the elected officials. So, you know, where does that put us at that point? Then those officials can determine how everything gets structured.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And again, this is why, because conventions are so powerful by their nature, and this is one of the things we're running into, is we're getting opposition on from people telling us, no, no, no. One of the first things you'll hear on a radio talk show is that someone will call in and say, well, I'm not talking about a national convention,
a full-blown change of the Constitution.
We're just talking about an amendment convention as mentioned in Article 5, and I'm like,
they're the same thing.
Category error. They are the same thing.
It's exactly the same.
There is no such thing as a convention limited to an amendment. Once you empower one, the control of the convention is in the hands of the delegates, and they can do anything they want. Now, are they completely empowered to change the system? No.
Well, that one is a qualified no.
That's right.
Because if you remember, the original delegates to the 1787 convention were not empowered to totally change the system either. However, that's exactly what they did.
That's exactly what they did. And if you've ever, as Barry and I have just been involved in a research project to look at the various Federalist and Anti-Federalist writings and speeches and those kinds of things, the debate was rather rancorous, and one of the main tripping points was the fact that the federal government was being given too much power, and there was no Bill of Rights in it.
That's right, and that led to, as you know, later on we ended up with a Bill of Rights.
That's right.
After the Constitution had been ratified by the states, under a ratification procedure that was in the document to be ratified.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. The old Articles of Confederation, which were the highest law of the land at the time.
They're right. That was the governing document.
That was the governing document. The legislators were bound, and the states had agreed by contract to obey its tenets. And what came out of that, basically there was an article called Article 13.
Mm-hmm.
And Article 13 required that if any changes were to be made to the Articles of Confederation, that all 13 states had to agree. It had to be with unanimous consent. Okay, so knowing full well that they weren't going to get unanimous consent, after we've discussed this, I think on Monday, we talked about the fact that the first act was to toss out,
the first vote was after the convention was convened. And the president of the convention was picked, who was George Washington.
That's right.
The first vote was that all deliberations were to be done in absolute secrecy.
Absolute secret. Then the next set of things they did was decide that we're going to throw out the Articles of Confederation. Well, they knew full well, since only 12 states showed up, Rhode Island didn't bother to send delegates because they didn't want to play, and they were always the troublemaker.
Good for them.
The delegates knew they were not going to get unanimous consent. So what they did was they rigged up this mechanism whereby the new Constitution would be ratified by an entirely separate procedure. And that procedure was 3/4 of the states, of the existing states,
mm-hmm.
out of 13, which was nine.
If
a minimum of 9 states ratified, that meant the old Articles of Confederation passed away and the Constitution took effect. Now, here's the problem. You've got law sitting there, and it's existing law, and they didn't change it.
That's right.
They bypassed it.
They totally bypassed it.
Now, why can they do that? Let me ask you a question after this talk on conventions.
Certainly.
And the power of conventions. Why were they able to do that?
Because a convention is the highest lawmaking body in the land, and they have plenipotentiary power to change the form of government.
That's right. All conventions are by their nature what is called plenipotentiary. In other words, they have all power. They are the highest governing body in what's called the body politic.
That's right.
And the body politic is all men, women, and children who live in a geographic region.
A jurisdiction.
That's a specific jurisdiction.
That's correct. And so, that, ladies and gentlemen, that's the big concern. Right now, our legislators, including Senator Coley, and I certainly am going to have some talks with him about this, are going under a bad assumption based on silence. And their bad assumption based on silence is that anything that comes out of a convention that they may call with this Article 5 call will be bound by the existing U.S. Constitution's Article 5 requirements.
That's right.
And there's absolutely nothing to hold that to, considering we have the example, we have the precedent. Remember, we base all of our law now on precedent. We have the precedent of our original convention doing exactly the opposite of what our current state legislators are assuming is going to be the case. You see, they're assuming that, well, number one, we can bind our delegates, and number two, everybody's going to operate by the rules we're living under right now. That didn't happen then, and given our environment, I don't think it's a certainty that it will happen now.
No, and in fact, basically, all the assumptions are really just incredibly bad. And unfortunately, they were also bad in a lot of cases in 1787.
Well, that's true.
A lot of people did not understand the procedure. And in fact, a lot of the same kind of nonsense was used. The same kind of crisis type thinking was used to get the first constitutional convention.
That's right. And that original crisis was
Shays' Rebellion.
Shays' Rebellion. That's
Shays'
right.
Rebellion, essentially. We will not go into this history. If you want a history of this, Camp American did a... I did a 2-hour presentation at Camp American on the history of how we got the first constitutional convention, and it's a doozy. And frankly, I think everybody would be well placed to go out to www.campamerican.com and purchase a copy of this. It's 2-hour long video. It's two DVDs, and avail yourselves of the history of it, because it's actually kind of fascinating.
Absolutely. You know, that's the other thing you bring up, Chuck. As we're talking about these issues, many things that we're talking about, folks can go to our website.
That's right.
At principledpolicy.com or campamerican.com.
That's
and
right.
Find many of these resources, find these materials. You can even find a briefing paper we did. If you go and you look and you Google up Constitutional Convention or Article 5, you'll find a policy bulletin that we did on constitutional conventions, crises, and coups. Our position on the calling of a new constitutional convention, some of which we've been talking about this week. Now, tomorrow we're going to be discussing, wrapping up on this issue and discussing why we need to have you contact your state legislator to educate them on why this is a bad idea.
See you tomorrow at 5:30.